Good evening. I invite you to turn to Hosea. Hosea is a book that was written about the same time as Amos, as well as Isaiah. Isaiah, of course, prophesied to the southern kingdom. Amos, as you may recall, was a prophet to the northern kingdom, albeit he was from Judah. The experts say that Amos prophesied about 755. They give 750 as a time period for Hosea. All of them, or most of them, start with the same list of kings that were ruling during those days: Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah. I mention that because Amos speaks to the same kingdom, of course, here as Isaiah, and Amos presents a picture of a God who is angry. The very beginning starts with "the Lord is roaring." Amos chapter 1, verse 2, "And he said, 'The Lord roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem.'" Very different kind of message that we're going to see in Hosea. I anticipate perhaps just two sermons from Hosea, so it should be a short series. I guess by way of introduction, I think Isaiah said it well when he said in Isaiah 54, verse 5, "For your Maker is your husband, the Lord of hosts is his name, and your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. He is called the God of the whole earth." So not only do you in that verse have the idea of God as Israel's husband, you also have the word Redeemer. If you know much about Hosea, you'll know that that's going to be a theme that comes up. It's not going to be in our lesson tonight, chapter 3 and the redemption of Israel. But just so that you get an idea about the layout of the book, it kind of has an interesting layout, and that is that chapters 1 through 3 basically tell the story, the entire story, leaving, of course, out some of the details, but it is the story. It's got the adultery of Israel. It's got God charging Israel with spiritual adultery. Then you've got the verdict of God being handed down. And beyond that, you've got God's promised probation period. And I think probation is the right word there, especially when you get to the way that he talks about the time period where he receives them back, that verse 4 of chapter 3, "The children of Israel shall abide many days without king or prince, sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or teraphim. And then afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God." There was this time period from the, I'm going to redeem, I'm going to buy them back and receive again to myself. But there's this, going to be this window, this time period where they're going to just be in a holding pattern with God and Israel. It's kind of like a probationary period. But you've got all that in the first three chapters. And, you know, as it breaks then down from in all of these chapters that follow, with the exclusion of 6, 11, and 14, all of these show that the case against Israel is strong. The case that I'm referring to is the one mentioned in chapter 2, verse 2, where Hosea says, "Bring charges against your mother, bring charges." And you've got that that wording again in chapter 4. Where in verse 1 he says, "For the Lord brings a charge against the inhabitants of the land." And so you've got basically, this is like the Cliff Notes version, I guess, chapters 1 through 3. It's the abbreviated story. And then 4 and all these other chapters, it's kind of an unpacking. It's kind of a fuller picture of what these charges were and what they were all about. And if 6, 11, and 14 are the exclusions to this, then what do you have there? Well, if the case is strong against Israel, these chapters show that the love of God is stronger than the case that was made, that was being made against them. Well, I want to start in chapter 1 by noting what it was to which Hosea was initially called. So it says in verse 2, that "When the Lord began to speak by Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, 'Go, take yourself a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry, for the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord.'" Now, notice that when he says began in verse 2, the Lord began to speak by Hosea. It's interesting to note that Hosea was not first called to go and preach, but to go and get married. God has some creative ways, of course. In times past, in getting his message across, God forbid Jeremiah to marry because his life would be a life of hardship. It would have been appropriate for him to marry. Ezekiel, God had taken his wife away from him. You may recall, God took his wife away in the midst of his prophecy against Judah and the days that Babylon came and took them away. And he was told not to mourn as a sign to the captives that this was God's judgment against them. And that he should not show any pity because God was not going to show any pity. And of course, God had an entirely different message for Israel when he commanded Hosea to go and take for himself a wife of harlotry. The word translated harlotry or whoredoms could have applied to an adulterer or adulteress, a fornicator, or a prostitute. There's some question as to whether or not this woman that he was supposed to go and marry, was she a practicing prostitute? Was it somebody that was in that profession at the time? Or is this somebody that was traveling down that path and was more a woman of the world who would bear the fruit of the seed that had been planted in her heart? And so, like Homer Haley puts it, he says, she was not unchaste at the time of the marriage, but was a maiden who was brought up under the influence of idolatry and whose character would have been planted, and in whose character would have been planted the seed of immorality. Thus, in a certain amount of time, she would bear the fruit of her idolatrous practices. So, you've got those two options to choose from. Another commentator, Kylan Delitzsch, says that she was a woman of whoredom. And she was a woman whose business or means of livelihood would have consisted in prostitution. So, it seems to me, based upon what follows, that Brother Haley had it right when he talked about her as being a woman of the age, and based on the way that she was dressing, the way that she conducted herself, and the easy sort of living that she seemed to lead, that this is not somebody who is going to be trustworthy. This is not the kind of woman that you would want to bring home to your parents. And whether or not one or the other position is more accurate than the other, I'm just fairly confident that God had a hand in bringing Hosea together with the right, wrong kind of woman. So he made that happen, of course, by his power. Now, don't think that Hosea simply decides beforehand, well, I'm just not going to love this one. I can see where this is going. I'm not going to fall for this. Hosea, according to chapter 3, verse 1, he loves this woman. He fell for her. He has given his heart to her. Where he has said, go again, love a woman who is loved by a lover. And so the instruction is to love her again, to receive her again, implying that he really did love her. Anyway, he takes this woman, Gomer, to himself, and it says that she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel. Jezreel is a word that means, or is translated, I will scatter. And he says, for in a little while I will avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu, and bring an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And we recall that Jehu was told to go and rid the earth of Ahab and his descendants and all who belonged to him. There's some question as to whether or not he exceeded his mandate in the those that he did put to death. There's some question in my mind about the men with whom he had made a verbal contract, saying if you deliver the princes to me, and you know they delivered the heads, you may recall, then you can go free. But then it says later on in that text that he caused these elders of the city to lose their life as well. So it might refer to his exceeding the mandate and killing some of the wrong people, or it just may refer to the attitude or the motivation of Jehu in carrying out the edict of God to put them to death. That is not that he was God's righteous judgment and carrying that out, but he was really doing this because he wanted to do it. And certainly it would have served him well in order to establish the kingdom under himself, and you would have wanted to do that. So we know that Jehu did not serve the Lord, and he did not follow him, even though he was obviously very motivated to kill Ahab and his household. So whatever that shortcoming was there, they were going to suffer for that because of what Jehu had done in that bloodshed that he was guilty of. So what I want you to think about, though, is it says that they bore him a son, and that his name would be Jezreel, or I will scatter. So think about that every time when someone would come up to you, and they would see you with your wife, Gomer, and they would see the baby, and they'd be drawn to the baby like everyone is, right? And they'd say, well, what's his name? And Hosea would say, oh, his name is God is going to scatter. God is going to scatter you. Just think of the awkward moment there. It's like, I was just trying to be nice. You know, I was just trying to be friendly. I thought the baby was cute. Sorry. And he turns that awkward moment into a teaching opportunity for this opportunity for the Word of God to prick their heart and recognize that they are not safe in the eyes of God. And then it says that she conceived again and bore a son. Do you notice anything different about verse 6 and verse 3? In verse 3, it says that she conceived and bore him a son. And then in verse 6, it says she conceived again and bore a daughter. It doesn't say that she bore him a daughter, just that she bore a daughter. I wonder if there's something there. I wonder if that's the difference. I wonder if this is the point where she, the seed that had been sown in her character was now producing fruit. And this was then a daughter of another. So God said to him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have mercy on the house of Israel. Lo-Ruhamah means no mercy. I will utterly take them away. Compare this to the message of Amos, chapter 9. Again, it said they were contemporaries. Verse 8 of Amos 9 says, behold, the eyes of the Lord God are on the sinful kingdom, and I will destroy it from the face of the earth. Yet I will not utterly destroy the house of Jacob. So he says of Israel, I will utterly destroy. I will utterly take them away. Yet I will have mercy on the house of Judah. Amos and Hosea agree. And what is it that history bears out? Judah was allowed to return. Israel never was allowed to return to their land. All right. So yet I will have mercy. Verse 7 says, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword or battle, or by horses or by horsemen. So I'm going to deliver them. I will save them by the Lord God, but I'm not going to do it by any earthly means, by any military means. I'm going to do it by the name of God. Now, doesn't that fit well historically with what happened in 701, approximately 701 BC, when Hezekiah took the letter from the Assyrians and spread it out before the Lord, and in one night, hundreds of thousands of the enemy died in the camp as they were encamped against the people of Judah. He did. He delivered them, but not by sword, not by battle, horses, or horsemen, but by the angel of the Lord dispersed to deliver the people of God from Judah. And then he says that she, again, after she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bore a son. Didn't bear him a son, but she bore a son. Then God said, if there was ever any doubt with Lo-Ruhamah about whose it is, God said, name this one Lo-Ami, because Lo-Ami means not mine. It's not mine. Again, think about that scenario with, what's your baby's name? Oh, it's not mine. That's awkward. We don't even know each other here. This is probably a family business. Maybe you won't want to keep that to yourself. No, I'm just answering you the question. The child's name, not mine. And the indication there, the reasoning for that is that God was trying to tell the people that you who once were a people, my people, who I brought out of the land of Egypt with a mighty arm, were no longer going to be my people. This was God's certificate of divorcement. It's like what he says later in chapter 2, verse 2, where he says, "For she is not my wife, nor am I her husband. Let her put away her harlotries from her sight." Even, I think that's interesting, even in that scenario where God says, "We're through. You're not mine, I'm not yours," there is still a call. There is still an urging of repentance that God is trying to get. It's not like, "I wash my hands of you and we will never have anything whatsoever to do with each other ever in the future." So we're gonna, if you know Hosea, you know that you just can't make that statement. Yes, as a nation, I am going to utterly destroy and there will be no return. But there was still a call. There was still an invitation for people to stop or cease from their harlotries. All right, so let's get into chapter 2 a little bit and talk about Israel and their unfaithfulness. Chapter 2, verse 5 will be kind of the heading for this section, and that is, "I'm going to pursue my lovers." That was her attitude. "Their mother has played the harlot. She who conceived them has behaved shamefully, for she said, 'I will go after my lovers. I will pursue them.'" I just want you to notice a few facts about that pursuit. And by the way, this is not merely a pursuit of some 2,750-year-old dead people. This is the pursuit of sinners today who make the same pursuits, the same foolish pursuit to go after other gods, that is, other pursuits or other passions or other means of finding some fulfillment in life. We're going to find out that the same things that led them away in their hearts, away from God, that made him so angry. That Hosea, I don't mean to imply that Amos talks about an angry God, but Hosea talks about a loving God. There's a lion in Hosea too. He is a lion. He is a young lion in Hosea. And the same things that angered him about their unfaithfulness will anger him as well today. So we need to be aware of those things and turn away from them. But I want you to notice the selfishness of her pursuit. "I will pursue my lovers," and she says in verse 5, "who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink." Who's this all about? When we depart from God and we start thinking about what's good for me and I've got to do for me and mine and got to live my life, and we start trying to take ownership of that which doesn't rightfully belong to us, who are we thinking about? It's like the rich man in Luke chapter 12. He said, I got to tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And then he says, "Soul, take your ease. Eat, drink, and be merry." He's thinking about himself. So there's the selfishness of the pursuit. Also need to consider the awful cost. What was at stake here? Well, what's at stake here is your relationship with your husband. You're going to lose your husband. You're married now to the greatest husband that you've ever could have been married to. He is the ideal husband. Ephesians 5, he is the perfect, you know, this is the kind of husband that loves you like Christ loved the church and gave himself for you. You want to squander that? Think about the awful cost of what you're going to sacrifice. I watched a video, I haven't seen very many of these, it's kind of a modern teaching tool, I guess, for some people, but, you know, in our modern day with internet, there are people who make video illustrations. And one of the video illustrations I saw on this point of infidelity from Hosea was, it starts with a man and a woman in their bedroom, and the woman is just frantically throwing clothes into her suitcase from the dresser, and you got the man just kind of sitting there, arms folded, "Don't do this, please stop, can we talk about this?" And you're thinking, yeah, I've seen this before, right? Every drama in the world has this sort of thing. Every, you know, romantic drama pictures this. You know, what dumb thing did the husband do? And now she's mad and she's leaving. And then all of a sudden she says, "Look, I cheated on you. You don't deserve to be treated like that. I can't stay." And he's sitting there. It's kind of turning the tables on who did what to whom and who's trying to leave and for what reason. "No, I don't want you to leave." And he's trying to call her back. "And can we just talk about that? I want you to stay." And she sits down and starts talking about all the things she did. And we're going to get into chapter 2, some of the awful things that this woman did. Like, for example, in verse 8, "She didn't know that I gave her grain, new wine, and oil, and multiplied her silver and gold. And so that which she thought she was pursuing and would attain by her own pursuits in following after other lovers," he says, "you didn't know that I was providing you everything that you needed. And in my giving of those things, what did you do with it?" Verse 8, "which they prepared for Baal." They took of my blessings. They took my gifts. And they re-gifted it. They repackaged it. And they gave it to another. I think there's some drama there. I think there's some emotional meat there. You give something that is so very special and precious and needful to someone that you love, and they say, "Oh, this will be perfect. I'm going to give this to my lover." Wow, that's painful. That hurts. Look again at verse 12. "And I will destroy her vines and her fig trees, of which she has said, 'These are my wages that my lovers have given me.'" Now she even attributes these things as having come from somebody else. It reminds me of what Malachi said of Judah later on in 400 BC, that they took from what was stolen. They stole, I believe it was from their brother or sister, and they offered what it was stolen as a sacrifice to God. Just think about the awful cost of the adultery and the separation from the husband that was better than life itself. Also, the terrible risk that was involved. "Lest I strip her naked and expose her as in the day she was born and make her like a wilderness." Now, we don't have a time to do it, but just right in there, Ezekiel 16, verses 1 through 13 there. Ezekiel 16, 1 through 13 would have been a great text to have been able to read, because when he talks about exposing her as in the day she was born, you may recall how that Ezekiel describes, as God reminisces what it was like in the beginning when I found you and when I came and I saw you wallowing in your own blood, and I took you and I washed you and I clothed you and I made you somebody. I elevated you. I lifted you up. I made you rich. You went from the dregs of society. You went from the gutter, and I put you in the penthouse. And here he was. Here he's saying the same thing. "I'm going to expose you, and I'm going to take everything that I gave you." But you know what's interesting about that? Verse 6, where it says, "Therefore, behold, I will hedge up your way with thorns and wall her in so that she cannot find her paths anymore." This is not the behavior of a scorned lover trying to get vengeance. This is the behavior of a God who is trying to keep from her the false joy that she thinks she's going to find in these pursuits. So that when she is kept from that joy, so that when she does, you got the effect on the children, but when she does realize that this divorce has led to such dissatisfaction, and that this pursuit has not made her happy, she will reach the point where she says, "I am going to return to my first husband, for then it was better for me than now. For she did not know that it was I who gave her these things." So God, even in his rejected state, God is still providing the means for her to reach this conclusion, that as she chases her lovers, he does not allow her to be overtaken with them. It says she will chase her lovers but not overtake them. She will seek them but not find them. That means she's not finding what she's looking for. She, like the prodigal son, is going to come to herself in return. That's what God is trying to accomplish there. And so that is what her pursuit looks like. The face of these things, as it is broken down through throughout the book of Hosea, when we talk about spiritual adultery, what does that look? What are we talking about here? What does that look like? If you just go and make a list of the things that they were guilty of, I can't cover all of them, of course, but just some of the things that I found in my reading of it were, number one, they looked to other gods. They trusted in other gods, and they loved the raisin cakes of the pagans. That is, they loved what it was that the gods of this world, when they recreate and fashion God in their image, they like the fringe benefits. They like what accompanies a God of your choice. Worshipping God, like they say, in the church of your choice, they like what is associated with that. Lots of stuff that men choose. Lots of stuff that appeals to the flesh. That's the same kind of thing. They love the raisin cakes that were offered in service to the pagan gods. In chapter 4, verse 13, similarly, it says that there was selfish religious perversion. It says, they offer sacrifices on the mountaintops and burn incense on the hills under oaks, poplars, and terebinths. Why? Because their shade is good. Imagine of all of the factors that come into the decision about how we're going to worship God. This is comfortable. This feels good in the heat of the day. Because their shade is good. Reminds me of Jeroboam, doesn't it, you? When he said, this is too hard. It is too hard for you to travel that far. Here, let's put these altars at Dan and Bethel so that we can provide a convenient means of worshiping the Lord. You ever heard of churches that provide drive-through communion? We're talking about, obviously, the same kind of thing. Or the churches that say, don't trouble yourself to get out of bed and get dressed and come in to worship. Just get online and watch this sermon and send us your money. And I don't know if that's down here, but that was big in Tulsa. Church TV and that sort of thing. It's very much a message and a method of convenience religion because their shade is good. Which prophet was it that said, woe to you who are at ease. At ease in Zion. You've also got chapter 10, verses 5 and 6. Certainly wasn't for lack of religious or spiritual zeal that they were being judged. No, you've got the inhabitants of Samaria fear because of the calf of Beth Aven. By the way, Beth Aven is translated house of vanity, and it was used as a substitute for what you would have expected, perhaps, which would have been Bethel, which is house of God. So Hosea doing a play on word there, where he says the calf of the house of vanity rather than the house of God. For its people mourn for it, and its priests shriek for it, because its glory has departed from it. The idol also shall be carried to Assyria. Now what idol? The calf of Bethel? We're talking again about Jeroboam's calf. A lot of time has passed from this point. We're talking 300 years or almost maybe 250 years since he has erected that calf. And nobody, you hear people talk about king of Israel, there was no good king in Israel. Well, that's right. If it were Judah, we would have expected somebody to have taken that down by now. But it's been there for 250 years. Verse 9, Israel, Hosea says, O Israel, you have sinned from the days of Gibeah. This goes back to Judges 19, where Israel rose up and did not deliver those men who were guilty of such awful atrocities and terrible immorality, and they fought with Judah. So this has been going on for a long time. But notice that the priests are shrieking for it. There's certainly a lot of zeal there on behalf of their calf. It's not for lack of zeal. But like Romans 10, 1 and 2, they have a zeal for the gods or God, but not in accordance to knowledge. And by the way, every one of these things we're talking about is rooted back in their lack of knowledge. As chapter 4, verse 6 says, my people perish for lack of knowledge. Chapter 5, verse 11, you've got the fact that they walk by human precept. This is helpful for today when we talk Bible authority. It says, Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment because he willingly walked by human precept. That's what we would expect from a man who, like Jeroboam, created these calves and erected them in Dan and Bethel, and it says that they recreated the priesthood, and he allowed anybody that wanted to be a priest, he could go ahead and be a priest, and they just appointed a day for a feast. It's just, I think it says that whatever he concocted out of his own mind, he picked this day out of his own heart and said, we're going to have a feast that day. Well, just like Israel, willingly walked by human precept. And think about how that contrasts with Jesus, who said, in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. All right, look at chapter 7, verses 1 and 2. Just so that we don't get the idea that idolatry is all about graven images exclusively, it says, when I would have healed Israel, then the iniquity of Ephraim was uncovered, and the wickedness of Samaria, for they have committed fraud. A thief comes in, a band of robbers takes spoil outside. They do not consider in their hearts that I remember all their wickedness. Now their own deeds have surrounded them. They are before my face. They make a king glad with their wickedness and princes with their lies. They are all adulterers. It's interesting there that God associates thievery, fraud, their wickedness, their lies, all of them under the umbrella of their spiritual adultery. It fits well with Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, that says that covetousness is idolatry. And so whatever it is, don't think in terms of, I haven't bowed down to anything lately. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're free from idolatry or that we have fled from it. All right, and then you've got chapter 8, verse 4, that talks about the perversion of the leadership of Israel. And there, we might call it, speaking in church terms, in the assembly and the organization of the church, they made kings, or they set up kings, but not by me. Again, this sounds a lot like because he willingly walked by human precept. So they set up kings, but not by me. They made princes, but I did not acknowledge them. Oh, it was official. It was, it looked like it was on the up and up. They had their king. They had their princes, he says. Unlike what the law had said in Deuteronomy 17, verse 15, where it talked about the fact that that would be of the Lord. He said, I didn't acknowledge. I don't care that it was official or that somebody did sign off on it. I didn't. Think about the implications to an eldership, like in a church that does not appoint qualified men to serve in that capacity. They set up elders, but not by me. They had their women preachers, and they had this and that, and it wasn't by me. Like David, who said, because we did not seek him according to the proper order, 1 Chronicles 15, 13. They needed to learn that lesson as well. All right. Wrapping this up, let's consider God's unconditional love. Chapter 2, verse 6. In spite of all of this, as we've noted, that he was not going to treat her in such a way that all he's trying to do is hurt her. He's not just trying to make her pay for the pain. In fact, he's trying to save her so that he builds up the hedge and he walls her in so that she cannot get the satisfaction from that lifestyle that she thought she would get. And in spite of the cruelty of her unfaithfulness, not that she said, I love you and I'm trying, but I'm just weak and I want to go away from you. But because of the cruelty of her taking what was God's and giving it to the Baals and saying, I didn't get this from God. I got this because of my own hard work. Like she would later say in Hosea. I'm not sure I'd be able to find it in time, but she pulled one of those Deuteronomy points, and that is because I was so strong and because I worked hard, I acquired all of these things. In spite of that, he still attempts to allure her back. Look at verse 14. He says, therefore, behold, I will allure her, I will bring her into the wilderness and speak comfort to her. That is probably the most remarkable phrase, at least in the first couple of chapters, that just boggles the mind. In fact, if anybody else were to say this about a woman like this today, if you had a friend in this situation, and you said, maybe what I need to do is try to allure her, you would say, you're crazy. Have some self-respect. Stand up for yourself. What's wrong with you? You're weak. Why would you try to allure somebody that had done that to you? She's getting what she deserves. And yet God, you know, like he would say also, God is not man. God is the Lord. And it's because he is the Lord that he is, this is chapter 11, verse 9. I will execute the fierceness of my anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come with terror. And that just highlights chapter 2 there in verse 14. It's because he's God and not man that he would care one whit about them or us in that state. And then finally, chapter 2, 21 through 23, God promises that reconciliation of the marriage covenant. So that what was at one time a promised scattering, a promised merciless warfare against them, and then a separation so that these were no longer my people. He says the days were coming and have come. I say and have come because Peter speaks of this in 1 Peter chapter 2. You might have not realized this connection before, but have you noticed that the chosen priesthood, the holy nation to which we have been called, highlights every one of these aspects? You're a holy nation, his own special people, so that what was at one time not mine, now you are his own special people. We've handled then lo me, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. You were once not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. And so, no longer are they like those under Lo Ruhamah, of whom there would be no mercy. Well, what about that first one, Jezreel? I will scatter. Look at it again. His own special... Let's see. It says, your chosen generation, royal priesthood, holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness. No longer are we scattered. We're called. We're called to come in together, to be one in one body. The love of God for this unfaithful sinner, for you and me, is amazing. It's remarkable. And the invitation is before you this evening for you to respond to that kind of love, for that willingness to restore the relationship of a slighted, of an abused husband who again has open arms, who wants to have you back. He wants you to see that that life is not fulfilling. And if you've come to that determination, you realize that apart from God, there is no joy, there's no happiness or peace, then we invite you by his invitation to come and return to him and obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. Repent, turn from your sins, confess your faith in Jesus, and be baptized for the forgiveness of sins. If we can help you with any of that, please come forward now while we stand and sing.